Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. In this episode, I speak with Inner Circle co-coach Susan Niebergall, and we basically did a big Q&A. I'm super excited about it. It was one of my favorite episodes thus far, so we're probably going to do more open Q&As. And that's all I will say about that. So let's get into it. What's going on, Susan?
Not much. What's going on? Great to be here.
It is wonderful to have you in New York City. Preparing for the September 2020 edition of the Inner Circle.
Yeah.
All done. Just got to write the training program now.
We got a lot done.
So what I just did is I went on my Instagram and I put up a Q&A, asked me a question, and got a bunch of them. And I figured we would go through and sort of just chat over a couple of the better questions that I got on the Q&A, and we can just sort of riff on both of our answers.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so one of the questions, very brief, very good question, was, are rest days necessary? What do you think, Susan?
Yeah, oh boy, this speaks to me because I was that person that didn't want to take a rest day. Yeah, they are necessary. And you and I have had this conversation so many times about the fear of taking rest days and what that's really about. But the short answer is yes, your body needs to recover.
Let's do the long answer. Let's go. What's it about? Like,
I honestly think that people that don't want to take rest days, and I raise my hand because I was that person, is because they're afraid to. Afraid of if they do, they're not working hard enough. They're not doing enough. They're going to lose progress. They're not going to make any more progress. They're going to get fat. All those things are the fear from not from taking a work day, a rest day. I know for me, I thought more was better too. Like the more I did it, the better, right? It has to be, because the more exercise I do, the more calories I burn or the more muscle I'm gonna build and all that. I wasn't even thinking about what I was potentially doing to my body physically, but I also was in denial of the fear factor. Mm-hmm. That it was actually, I was afraid to not do that. Mm-hmm. And for all those reasons that if I didn't do that, I was screwed. And I think that is something that drives most people who want to do two-a-days and work out 6-7 days a week. And it's something that I know I lied about, and I lied to myself about it, I guess. I told everybody I loved exercise. That's why I did it so much. Mm-hmm. And there was truth in that. I did and still do love to exercise, but I wasn't being completely honest. Guilt by omission kind of thing.
And it wasn't even, like, you weren't fully aware. Like, there wasn't a lot of self-awareness with this. It was like you knew you loved it. I think this is one of the issues with this. A lot of people who work out 6-7 times a week, multiple times a day, is they're often told by their friends and family, you're so disciplined. This is like, you're so disciplined. You never miss a day. And then they wear that like a badge of honor. Mm-hmm. And the idea of not taking rest days becomes part of their
warrior status.
Part of their warrior status, their ego, their sense of self. And the idea of taking a rest day or taking a break, even though they would never recommend to a friend to work out every day, they would never say to anyone else, you need to do this. For themselves, it becomes something that they need to do, or else they will lose status. They have a perceived status that other people think of them as, and they can't break mm-hmm. that. And then also, I think the fear factor of, as soon as I say fear factor, I think of Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
But of like the fear factor of losing all their progress. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the major aspects of that is I've never met someone who works out every single day who is 100% happy with their body, with their strength, with their fitness. So a lot of them are working out of fear. Mm-hmm. The whole reason they're working out every day is not because they love their body and they love what they're doing. They're working out every day because they're scared that if they don't, then they will go further away from their progress. They will lose more progress. They will gain body fat. They'll lose muscle mass. They'll lose strength. So this every workout is done out of a place of fear rather than out of a place of love, which creates a very skewed relationship with exercise.
Oh, 100%. And I mean, I lived that for so long. And I like to tell this really brief, funny story about when you and I first started working together and how you scaled me back from 6 days to 4 days. And the very first rest day, I remember sending you a message going, what am I supposed to do? And I'm sure, and I tell this because I know the eyes were rolling in your head. It's like, oh God, here's another one of those people. But you told me to rest, and I basically whined and complained. And you told me, okay, you could go to the gym and hop on a bike, but your heart rate has to stay at some super low level. I don't even remember what it was. So I'm like, okay, great, I'm gonna do that. And I got on, I was miserable. I went up and did it, and I'm like, I will never do this again. And I sent you that message. I will never, ever do this again. I will take a rest day, like it says, to rest. And then what I learned from that was my workout that came next was 10 times better. Mm. And that's a significant point to make here, is that when you allow your body to actually rest and recover, your next workout is even more effective.
That's one of, I think, the parts that is the most important to communicate and for people to understand if they struggle with taking rest days, is that you often don't realize how run down you are and how tired you are chronically until you take a rest day or two rest days, then come back and your strength is like 1.5, 2x'd. You feel better, you have more energy. And then not to mention, you really look forward to that workout.
Yes.
You get excited about it. You get amped up for it. And I think this is one of the aspects of when you look at muscle growth, for example, but when you look at muscle growth and workout effectiveness, it's not just, yes, getting there is important. And if we're talking to someone who struggles with working out at all, then of course just getting to the gym is a huge win. But if we're talking about optimizing performance and people who go every single day, intensity is a driving factor for muscle growth and for progress overall. And when I talk about intensity, I really mean in terms of total weight lifted. So how heavy are you lifting? If you're going to the gym every day, a couple times a day, and you're not ever really, you're so tired chronically that you're not able to push yourself to get stronger, to lift heavier weight, then your body is always gonna look exactly the same. You're not gonna make much progress. Your strength isn't gonna increase. You're not gonna build much muscle because you're not progressively overloading. So if you aren't, even if you're going to the gym every single day, but you're not progressively overloading, then you're not gonna be making the progress you want. And almost in a ironic turn of events, the less you go to the gym 3, 4, maybe 5 times a week, and you give yourself more time to recover, the more intense you can train. And with that higher intensity comes better results.
Yeah, absolutely. Rest days are the best thing you could do for your health, for your workouts, for everything.
Yeah, mental health, emotional health, physical health, all of it.
Yep.
All right, so next question. They said, if I think about food all the time, should I be concerned? Is it because I'm overly restrictive?
That's interesting. You know, taking out some of the concerned words, you know, we don't need to push panic buttons here or whatever, but it would be something to look at, because most likely, I think, yeah, there's probably a sense of being overly restrictive. And that could be from the perspective of the circle of foods that you're eating. Maybe you have a very small food vocabulary, or maybe it's the quantity. Your meals aren't quite big enough to keep you feeling full and satisfied. Mm. Two different ways to look at that.
That's a great point. And actually, before I even talk on that, I think the verbiage concerned is a really important thing to discuss. Like, should I be concerned? I couldn't imagine answering this question, speaking with someone one-on-one, being like, yes, you should be concerned.
Right.
Just like, that will do nothing.
Right.
And I think it's the number of emails that I get with the subject line in all caps, help, I need help, !!! And they go in, they're like, I'm trying to lose the last 5 pounds.
Yeah.
Da, da, da. I'm like, all right, this is not like an all caps help subject line type of email.
Yeah.
That type of like, help, I'm scared, I'm concerned. It's like, that's not for
perspective.
In terms of thinking about food all the time, it is something to be aware of. And generally speaking, yes, it often comes from being overly restrictive.
Yeah.
There are many possible reasons, but the one that I think you and I see most come from being overly restrictive and oftentimes being too meticulous with tracking calories.
Mm-hmm.
The important distinction here is some people are more than able to meticulously track their calories without being, without letting it affect them. And other people, if they meticulously track their calories, it does negatively affect them. It does make them think about food too much. So this is a matter of self-awareness and understanding. If you notice that you are becoming obsessed with food from tracking your calories, that you're becoming obsessed, that you're never getting full. You're always thinking about food. Maybe like you have a list of foods that are quote unquote off limits. Mm-hmm. And then you find yourself watching the Food Network or going to food Instagrams and just, oh, I wish I could eat that. I wish I could eat this. And all day is just thought about wishing about the foods you wish you could eat. Then yeah, there's something that needs to be addressed here. And I think one of the first things that you should analyze is whether or not you are counting calories. And if you're getting obsessive about food and thinking about it all the time and you're counting calories, those two don't fit. Yeah. They're not two behaviors that match well. I think if you're obsessive with your food, you need to first stop counting calories and work on fixing that relationship with food first.
100%. And that could even mean pick a day and just don't track that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, start like that instead of going like cold turkey or whatever. Pick a day or two where you don't. Where you don't track, you know, you eat kind of how you normally eat, but you just don't write it down.
You mean like 1 day a week?
Yeah.
One day a week, just don't track.
Yeah, I mean, start simple like that, but I totally agree. I think you can be way over the top meticulous with things between tracking and what food you eat and how much, yeah, all of that, for sure. It's awareness. It's all about awareness.
Yeah, and I think the point that you brought up that is really insightful is looking at your meals. Are your meals not enough? Are they not big enough? Are they not? Do they not sustain you long enough?
Yeah.
Like I see this a lot of times with people who they'll sort of pick little bits throughout the day, mm-hmm. small little bites here mm-hmm. and there. They're afraid to sit down. I've seen this a lot. There are many people who are afraid to feel full.
Mm.
They're afraid to have such a big meal that they feel full because then they think their stomach is going to look big. They think it's going to like look fat, and that fear of feeling full often ends up leading to them to never actually get to a point in which they can feel satiated. They can feel full mm-hmm. anymore. And through doing that, they'll snack, they'll pick throughout the day, and then that will make them think about food all day because mm-hmm. all day they're never getting to a point in which they're actually satisfied.
Right.
So that's, for me, it's one of the reasons why I like the 3 plates, 2 snacks. Because when you're required to have all of your meals fit on 3 plates and then have 2 snacks, you're essentially... You are required to make, like, I want you to fill that 1 plate up. So for the 3 plates to start the day, each plate should be full. Mm-hmm. You should be doing your best to get full, to get satiated from each plate, to have it full with fruits and vegetables and protein and all of that, to make sure that you actually leave the table feeling satisfied.
Yeah. I think that fear of feeling full translates for a lot of people to, I'm fat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, feeling full is not the same as being fat, but they equate the two. Feeling full means I'm fat. And so they will avoid that by nitpicking all day, you know, little bits of this, little bits of this. And as you said, yeah, you never get satisfied. And so you're constantly thinking about, okay, what's my next little bite here or there mm-hmm. going to be? And that's the cycle for that.
It's so funny. They'll like maybe after a big meal, it'll be harder to button their pants.
Yeah.
Or for whatever reason, they get obsessive and they step on the scale and they had just had a big meal and they're like, oh my God, I weigh 3 pounds more. It's like, yeah, of course you weigh 3 pounds more.
Right.
You have a glass of water that's 16 ounces, you're going to weigh 1 pound more.
Yeah.
So it's, I think there's a lot of people not being logical with their reasoning and their thinking with this. And they just think, okay, well, I had a big meal. My stomach feels full. It's bolus. Now it feels really big. So I must have gained fat. That is not how we work.
Right.
Physiologically. Right. It's just, it's not how we work. I think it's important to be aware of the difference between feeling really full and actually gaining fat. Gaining fat isn't something you feel. It's not like you gain 0.4 ounces of fat and you feel it.
Right.
That's a process that takes time. Feeling full is hopefully, if we're lucky enough, you feel it throughout the day. One moment, like in one after a meal, you're full. Several hours later, you start to get hungry again. It's this coming and going, this ebb and flow of feeding yourself, getting full. Then you can go a few hours without thinking about food. You get your work done. You're with your family, your friends, whatever. Then you start to feel the hunger coming back and you feed yourself again, whether it's a higher protein snack or fruits or vegetables, until you get to the point where you have your next meal.
Yeah.
I was speaking with someone recently on a podcast. I forget her name. Really great woman. One of the things she said that really hit home with me was that one of the things that helped her lose a lot of weight was she stopped skipping meals. This is one of the best things I've heard. She was like, I didn't count calories. I didn't do anything. I stopped snacking and I started and I made sure I did not skip meals. Because what she would do is through skipping meals, she would end up getting really hungry, and then she'd binge later on at night. And she would think about it all day. She'd skip, she'd think about food until at night, then she'd binge. Whereas just by requiring herself to have X number of meals a day, she would actually get full from each meal, and then she wouldn't binge later on.
That's a great point. You know, I posted something the other day saying how it's fascinating how we think fat loss takes so long.
Mm.
And yet, if the scale goes up overnight, we're like, I gained a pound of fat.
Yeah.
It's great irony, isn't it?
It's very easy to become your own worst enemy.
Yeah.
Especially when you have that type of reasoning.
Yeah.
All right. So next question. The scale for me says my weight. Oh, sorry. I misread that. The scale for me says I have the same weight, but my clothing size keeps downsizing and I feel healthier. That's the end of the question. So there's no question there, but I think it's a good thing to talk about. What do you think about that?
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's great. And I hope that person was writing that as a good thing and not like a frustrated thing.
Right. Like, why isn't the scale going down?
Yeah. If it is out of a frustrated thing, we got to understand, you just mentioned some phenomenal progress. Two really important things. Your clothes fit better and you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what everybody's looking for. So I think that that's fantastic. And I know people get frustrated because they're so attached to that square little box that everyone stands on and the number that it regurgitates.
Yep.
And we lose sight of what that number actually means. I think that's a bigger picture problem, is that we equate that number with just fat.
Correct.
That's it. And not bones, organs, water, tissue, skin, whatever, all the list of things that it's actually weighing. And so then then our emotions get all involved and take over, and it's a disaster. But that scenario is like fantastic. Any of our inner circle members, we're like, congrats.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. A lot of people, despite knowing the scale isn't the end all be all, they get very wrapped up in wanting to see the scale go down. So, I mean, we've had people who say, you know, my measurements are going down, my clothes are fitting better, yeah, I'm feeling better, but the damn scale won't go down. And we're always like, why are you focusing on that? Now, who am I to talk, right? I mean, I think it's very easy. I think it's human nature to focus on the one thing that we don't like, as opposed to the million things we do like. I could get 999 amazing comments on a post, but I get one comment from someone being like, you're an asshole. That's the one comment I care about, right?
Yeah.
Like, every comment could be like, you're amazing, this is so helpful, I appreciate you, this is wonderful. One comment is, you're an asshole. I'm like, why does this person not like me?
Right.
It's like, same thing with the scale. The scale might not be going down, but your measurements are going down, your clothes are fitting better, you're feeling healthier, you're getting stronger, you're being consistent in the gym, you're drinking more water, you're sleeping better, all this stuff, but the scale's not going down, and then you trick yourself into thinking that means you're not making progress.
Right.
And that's just bullshit.
It's such bullshit. And I was talking to a woman not too long ago, kind of on the similar topic to this, and just, especially people in my age bracket, you know, we were brought up with a pretty simple view of the scale. It goes up, it's bad. It goes down, it's good. And that was it. Mm-hmm. That was just it. There was no explanation. None of us really even knew any of that. And that's how it's been for many people for many, 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 many years. And it's not something that's going to go away right away. But the more that you can start having conversations with yourself and talk about, list all, even if you want to write down all the things that have changed that are a positive, mm-hmm, like all the things that you mentioned, that's where you have to start. The awareness of what you're allowing your emotions to take over is super important, because it is not something that's going to be easy to wipe away. And in fact, I'll say this, if I step on the scale and I see it go up, I will not sit here and say, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, I get a little twang, a little gut kick, but I know now, and mm-hmm, that's all it is. I don't let it ruin my day. I don't go do extra stuff. I understand what it is. So it just kind of comes and goes, and that's that.
Yeah. I think the goal isn't to eliminate emotions.
Right.
The goal is to better manage your emotions and become aware of them, and to learn how to not let your emotions dictate your actions. If you step on the scale and it goes up 2 pounds on a random day, I think the ultimate goal is to get it to be where you just look at it and you're like, cool. Like, it doesn't bother you. But I think most people getting to a point where they have the negative emotion, they get a little bit upset about it, but by the time their foot hits the floor, they're off to the rest of the day. Like, it yeah. doesn't matter. Whereas most people, unfortunately, they see the scale spike up and they freak out. They think, well, what's going on? It must be my metabolism. I've been perfect with my nutrition. I need to get fat burning pills. This has ruined my day. I'm fat. I'm ugly. All this other stuff. And they have this downstream of effects that literally ruins the entire day. Yeah. It dictates how they're going to eat that day. Maybe they're going to starve themselves more. They're not going to eat well, or they're going to go completely off track and binge. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, the goal isn't to be an emotionless creature. The goal is to be able to do what is right regardless of your emotions.
Yeah, not letting them run the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for anything.
That's exactly right. All right, so another question. This one's really good for you, Susan. Any advice for a female looking to go into a muscle-building phase?
Yeah. Wow. I would say this: not listening to your own bullshit is going to be really important. And from the perspective of... you're not eating what you should be eating because in the back of your mind, you don't want to see that scale go up.
Mm.
Playing that game. And I totally get it because a month and a half that I was doing that, telling yourself you're not hungry when you could have eaten whatever calories you needed to eat, but you didn't want to do it because you knew the scale's going to start creeping up, which it will, by the way, and that is okay. And if you plan it out right, you're doing it in a controlled way. And I think the other thing, we think we build muscle, we have to eat. It's a feeding frenzy. I'm just going to stuff food in my face and mm-hmm. I'm going to be, you know, become not muscular, but fat and muscular. And that's not how it goes. But it starts with being aware that you have to allow the scale to go up. You have to stick with what you're supposed to do and not listen to the voices in your head that will want you to not do that because you're afraid of seeing the scale go up. That was the biggest issue for me.
Do you think that not just women, I know men do this too, but do you think a lot of women, they don't go into a muscle building phase because they aren't as lean as they want yet? And because they aren't as lean as they want yet, they just think they should perpetually be in a calorie deficit and they forever avoid maintenance yeah. or calorie surplus because they're not where they want to be yet? And do you think that inhibits them?
Absolutely, it does. I think some people will stay in a calorie deficit to lose that last teeny weeny little bit of fat
mm-hmm.
before they either deserve to go into something else or they feel ready because they don't want to build any muscle on top of any fat
mm-hmm.
or whatever. But absolutely, I think that's a huge problem. And the thing is, and you and I have talked about this so much, especially with the inner circle, is that sometimes that's exactly what you should do instead of trying to get that last little bit of fat off.
Yep.
You know, because once you start building muscle, then you start getting that lean and defined and toned, whatever word you want to use, look, your body starts to change, which yep. is really what everyone wants to do anyway. They want to lose fat. They say weight, but really it's fat. They want to look different.
Yep.
And so when you start doing muscle building, you will start to look different.
Yep.
And I think people are scared.
You know, there's an interesting mental component to training for fat loss versus training for muscle growth. And what I mean by that is oftentimes the workouts look very similar from a fat loss phase to a muscle growth phase. The volume might change a little bit, and maybe the exercise selection, depending on the individual, could change a little bit, but that's minutia. By and large, oftentimes the programs look the same, but from a mental side, when you're in a calorie deficit, maybe energy is lacking a little bit, you know muscle isn't going to be, muscle growth isn't going to be optimized, you're oftentimes just going to the gym to get it done
mm-hmm.
versus when your goal is muscle growth, you go to the gym to do work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're going to the gym to make progress, to get stronger, to lift more, to feel your muscles burning, because through that process, you're expecting a physical change, not just even physical, but also an objective change based on how much weight you're lifting, your progress in the gym. You're expecting to see and feel a legitimate difference through your workouts, where when it's fat loss, oftentimes it's easier to fall into the, well, I'm doing this to maintain my muscle and my strength, but I'm really going to get the results through nutrition, which is correct. Like, mm-hmm. that's generally how it works. But from a mental side, I think you get a huge boost of motivation and vigor and excitement when you go to the gym in a muscle gain phase, because you know that you're going to bring an intensity to that workout that you're going to challenge your body to be better than it currently is. And I think that mental and emotional shift gives people new excitement and new joy with their workouts that can make a huge change when they decide to go back to a calorie deficit in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, whatever it is.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's kind of like, I always thought of it as being like in an attack mode every time I go in there. I kind of gave myself mini goals every workout. And I talk about this a lot. I think intensity is really important here because you need to bring it. Mm-hmm. Or you won't see any change. And therein lies the difference, really, with who's driving the muscle-building car. If you don't bring intensity to your training, you're not going to build muscle anyway. So we've kind of flipped roles here to a degree.
Yep.
And I think it's super important to understand that you're going to have to get uncomfortable. You're going to have to really push yourself and bring it to your workouts, which to me is like the best thing ever. It's so much fun, and it is more enjoyable, and it is looked at differently than maybe, as you were saying, in a fat loss phase, maybe more checking a box than anything else. You don't want to lose anything there, except fat, you know, from your nutrition. You're doing the workouts to maintain more than you are to build.
Yep. Makes total sense.
Yeah.
What training advice would you give a woman looking to build muscle? Like, you've had tremendous success with your muscle building phases, and you've built a truly an extraordinary amount of muscle. From a training perspective, going to the gym, off the top of your head, what is 1, 2, 3 things, any of those, that you would give advice for a woman going to the gym trying to build more muscle?
I think the first one is what we were just talking about, intensity. That has to be number one from the perspective of how much weight are you lifting. So that brings you to, are you getting through all your sets and reps, you know, and they're okay, challenging, but they're not super hard. You need to be more on top of, okay, it's time to move up in weight.
What rep range would you generally, so like 50 reps, and I know the answer, but like, I think it's important, like for everyone listening, like what rep range would you recommend most people be in terms of trying to really challenge themselves?
You know, as you know, all my programs have everything from maybe 5 or 6 to, and I end at 20 sometimes.
Correct, yeah.
Within the same program. And that's, to me, the game changer, because you are training strength super hard at the beginning, and then I am training more accessory or whatever exercises, and my rep ranges have gone up. And what's challenging there is it's a total different feel, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's more endurance now, and now I can't do the same weight that I did for 6 reps when I'm having to do 20.
Correct.
So now I'm having to play that game, and I set myself little mini goals. Okay, now how am I going to get up to this? And one mistake I think people make is they feel like they have to stay at the same weight for all however many sets and however many exact reps before they can even move on.
Yep.
And I think that holds people back. Yeah. I don't think I've ever done that.
I think one of the issues I've seen, the issue I see with most men is that they tend to lift way too heavy and their technique is just disgusting. Their technique is awful. They shorten their range of motion in order to lift more weight. One of the major issues I see with women is that they'll either lift way too lightweight, maybe because they don't want to sweat or they don't want to like look bad in the gym, or oftentimes they'll do too high repetition. Like everything will be like 15, 20, 30 repetitions, because with that style of repetition, it's easier to feel the burn, right? You can feel more of a burning sensation, and they equate the burning sensation with muscle toning.
Yes.
They equate that burning with, oh, this is working, this is toning my muscle, this is burning fat in the area. That's not how it works. And I think what you're talking about, the initial beginning of the program, which is 3, 4, 5, 6 reps, very, very heavy, you're not going to feel the muscles working like you do in the 15, 20, 25, 30 rep range. You're not going to feel that type of burn. That's okay. You don't need that type of burn in order to make progress. If you're only chasing that burning feeling, you're chasing a feeling. You're not chasing a result.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at optimal programming for muscle growth, you need progressive overload as the most important part. And as part of that, you can progressive overload in the 3, 4, 5, 6 repetition range, very low rep, very high weight, and then go into maybe the 6 to 12 rep range. Mm-hmm. And then from there, go from the 12 to 20 rep range.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, you could go up to 30+ reps, but that's just outrageously uncomfortable in my opinion. Like doing 30 reps, 40 reps, 50 reps. Sometimes we'll screw around and we'll have fun with the inner circle and like put in this past month, did some 100 rep sets, which were just absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
But especially for glute growth. But generally speaking, between 5 to 20 rep range, starting off with the lower reps, heavier weight, and then as the workout goes, progressively getting into higher reps, relatively lower weight. But regardless of whether you're doing 5 reps or 20 reps, the last 2 to 3 reps of your set should be very difficult. Mm-hmm. It should be very challenging to do with proper technique, because that's when you're really challenging the muscle to grow. And if we're looking at the total number of effective reps per set, then that's when it becomes very important to challenge your muscles in those last few reps. Because if you finish your set and it was on a scale of 1 to 10, if it was a 7, 7.5, you might not have gotten as many effective reps for muscle growth. Versus if you're finishing your set and it was a 9 out of 10, then the last few reps were actually effective towards building muscle.
Yeah. And I would say along those lines, another thing to do is to make sure you're tracking your workouts, like with weight and where, so you can actually see how much you're actually pushing yourself and how much you're moving up or whatever. And then I guess the other thing I would say for anybody doing a muscle building phase is take pictures. And I didn't do a great job of that, and I really regret not doing a better job of that. I was able to throw some together, but take pictures at the beginning, front, side, and back, and do it regularly throughout, because you will be building muscle and you won't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, with fat loss, there's a lot of other ways that you can tell if you're losing fat. You know, your clothes, the scale, whatever. Muscle, it's not as, you don't have as many direct indications. So pictures are the best, or the absolute best. I was showing you some pictures today, and it's, didn't even realize it until I
you
saw it.
You would have known, yeah. Exactly.
So pictures are super important.
All right, so next question. My problem is not weight loss, but maintenance. Will joining your inner circle help me with this?
That is the best place you could be for maintenance, right? I mean, really?
Yeah.
I mean, just because we talk so much about maintenance, and we like to call it momentum in the inner circle. And I think that's super important, the verbiage that we chose for that. Because I think people think maintenance is a stagnation, and
correct,
that implies bad, that you're just kind of hanging out. We think it's very purposeful. And that's why we nicknamed it momentum, because we feel like you are building momentum to do whatever comes next, whether it's to go back into a deficit or even build muscle or whatever. It's so powerful, maintenance and momentum. So, so, so powerful. If you can get a hold of what that is for you, not only can you just live your life, but you can then, you have the power to eat a little less and be in a deficit, and eat a little more and be in a surplus. I mean, you own the world once you get that momentum down.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The first sentence, my problem is not weight loss, but maintenance. That is 99.9% of people's issue. And you could make an argument that it's 100% of people's issue, because anyone can lose weight.
Yeah.
Anyone. Like, if you are, and it doesn't matter if you're doing it properly. Like, you could lose weight from being very restrictive. You could lose weight from completely fasting. You could lose weight from doing a juice cleanse. You could lose any number of things. The problem for basically everybody isn't weight loss, it's maintaining that weight loss. So in order to understand how to actually maintain your weight, you first have to understand how to lose fat properly, how to use a sustainable method, right? Because if the methods are unsustainable, the results will be unsustainable. That's just the most important part. So I think a lot of people want to know how to go into a maintenance phase. They want, well, how do I go into maintenance? Before we can discuss how to transfer into maintenance, we have to discuss how to lose fat sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bit. You could have the best plan for maintenance in the world, and this is one of the issues a lot of people have, is they're like, okay, well, I'm going to lose 20 pounds as quickly as possible, and from there, then I'll go into maintenance. It's like, well, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go into quote unquote maintenance using a method that you didn't even use to get there. So you didn't build the practice. You didn't build the habits. You didn't do any of that. So you think you're going to do a juice cleanse to lose 20 pounds and then eat in a maintainable way to sustain that when you have zero practice with it. The reality is the difference between fat loss and maintenance is not very much.
Yeah.
The calorically, the difference between fat loss and maintenance is several hundred. It's not that different. So if you're going to try and lose weight in a very unsustainable way, juice cleanse, detox, whatever it is, by fasting for outrageously extreme periods of time, doing the ketogenic diet, completely removing carbs from your diet, and then plan to go into maintenance in a more sustainable way, you're doing that completely blind without any idea of what you're actually doing. So if you're going to be able to maintain your weight successfully, you have to lose your weight sustainably first and foremost. So that, I think, to answer the second part of your question, will the Inner Circle help me? Yeah, of course. Like, that's exactly what we do. I mean, in the Inner Circle, we have a fat loss manual, we have a maintenance manual, we have a muscle gain manual. Each manual will tell you exactly what you need to do in order to do that sustainably and enjoyably without giving up your entire life. So all of the information is there. Everything you could ever need to know about a sustainable, healthy fat loss phase, sustainable, healthy maintenance phase, sustainable, healthy muscle growth phase, it's all there. There's no questions, there's no ambiguity. Whatever you need to know, it's in there. But then on top of that, if we're really looking into the research in regard to what helps people maintain their weight loss, not just for a week or a month, but for a lifetime, a huge part of that is community. It's about who you surround yourself with. If you surround yourself with people who are not supportive of you, they don't encourage you, they don't eat in a similar way to you, they don't value exercise or nutrition or sleep, then you're significantly less likely to be able to maintain it. And I mean, Susan and I will both say, like at the very beginning, the most incredible part of the Inner Circle, the most valuable part of the Inner Circle is the community. It's the private members group in which everyone can interact and support each other and encourage each other. You go on there at any time of day, there's always new posts and comments and questions and people encouraging each other. We do live Q&As several times a week. It's like, if you want a community of people to support you throughout this whole process and answer your questions, I don't think there's any better place in the world.
No, and you and I both have been in so many groups, and this group is unique in so many ways, but the level of support and accountability that you can get and you can help give will be amazing. And to your point, I think knowing that you're not the only one that feels a certain way or that is struggling with something, that there are other people that you guys can shoot ideas off of each other, that is a difference maker.
Yep.
Just in general.
All right. So, last question. Before we jump to this one, if you want to join the Inner Circle, we'll put a link in the show notes. You can just go to www.sfinnercircle.com, hit join now, and you can join. We'll do the last question. This one I thought was very interesting, and I don't even know. I don't know what I'm going to say. It might take a minute to think about it. The question is: as a coach, what do you feel is the worst advice you have given? And I think this person asked this because earlier in the Q&A, someone asked, what is the worst advice you've ever been given? And that person, I believe they were asking me from a business perspective, like what's the worst advice anyone's ever given you in regard to your business? And at that point, my answer was, and I still very much stand by this, I've had a number of business coaches tell me to stop giving away so much free advice, stop giving away so much free content, because they'll say, like, people aren't going to want to pay you if they know exactly what, like, if they know what to do. And that's the dumbest advice ever. It's like, I've built my entire business on giving away things for free forever. Not only because it's the right thing to do, but I enjoy it. Like, I like to teach. I like to help. Mm-hmm. It's what I get the most enjoyment out of. And that's how I built my entire business from 2011, is giving away free content every single day over and over and over again. So I think that's probably the dumbest business advice I've ever been given. But as a coach, what do you feel is the worst advice you've ever given? Susan, what do you think?
Yeah, trying to recall. The one thing that pops into my head right away is not necessarily advice, specific advice I gave somebody, is how I functioned, what I did. I totally, at the beginning, when I was coaching in person, right after I got certified, I overprogrammed people like ridiculously.
Oh yeah.
I mean, just like
the too many exercises.
Too much just in general. And I was working at a gym where it was 30-minute sessions. Mm-hmm. So I was having to learn how to program it for 30 minutes. Because any kind of practice I had before that was more 45 to 50, whatever. So I was learning and I was trying to fit as much as I could, you know, in 30 minutes. And I, in the back of my head, was thinking, I have to have a lot of variety and a lot of stuff, or they're going to think this wasn't like enough.
Yep.
So it wasn't advice that I get, but I did that for a while until, and I will say a couple of my people would come back like they just got wiped.
Obliterated.
Yeah. They got obliterated. Yeah. And so, yeah, I had to learn from that, and I did. And it's so interesting that, well, I mean, I just look back on that now, and I just cringe. I mean, I cringe thinking of that. But, I mean, we all have stuff like that. But I think that was probably the worst.
Every single person's made mistakes in their life.
Like, yeah.
Again, ask any parent if they were a perfect parent. Oh, don't listen. They're going to, oh, my God, I made so many mistakes. It's like, if you ask anyone, like any field, like there's all people always make mistakes.
How about you?
I would say the first one that comes to mind is there was a period of time throughout my coaching career where I massively overemphasized my reaction when someone lost weight. So if someone would tell me like, hey, I lost weight, like they emailed me, an online coaching client would email me, like, and they'd send me their daily update, and they were cool. They had dropped 0.4 pounds. I'd be like, oh, hell yeah. I'd be like, that's amazing. And my mind was, I'm supposed to be their biggest cheerleader. I'm supposed to encourage them. And I think that from that perspective, it worked. The issue is if their weight spiked up, there would be a subsequent, oh, no, I don't want to tell you. They're ashamed. They think they did something wrong. And the issue was that it was my fault because I went so over the top with the scale decrease that it inherently made the scale increase bad.
Worse.
So going forward, I think, someone actually recently asked me this, I thought it was a really good question. They were like, if we're not supposed to celebrate the scale losses, then what are we supposed to celebrate? And I thought it was a great question. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm not saying don't celebrate scale losses. I'm saying don't look at any scale, in like any acute scale increase or acute scale decrease as the end all be all of progress. So if the scale goes down 0.4 ounces, that doesn't mean that you lost 0.4 ounces of fat, in the same way that if the scale goes up 0.4 ounces, it doesn't mean you gained 0.4 ounces of fat. For me, number one, I would say definitely celebrate your consistency. Look at the end of the month. How consistent were you? If you were 80% or more consistent, celebrate that. But I would say you could also celebrate milestones. Every 5 pounds, every 10 pounds, celebrate those milestones. If you're trying to lose weight, every 5 pounds, every 10 pounds, clearly you're doing something right if it's going in that direction and that trend consistently over time. I think if you celebrate each and every drop, every single time the scale goes down a little bit, then you're setting yourself up for failure, because for every increase, it's going to immediately associate with something bad. So I think that was my biggest mistake, in which someone would email me, oh, I lost 0.2. Oh, yeah, you're crushing it. Amazing. Yeah. Even though it was a good intent, I think it was a mistake, and that I should have been a better approach would be, hey, when you hit this amount of weight loss, then we'll have a big celebration. But in between this amount of weight loss, there are no good or bad weigh-ins. They're all just neutral.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point, and something easily overlooked, with the intent being you just want to be positive and supportive and all that kind of stuff, and not thinking, okay, what then the reverse of that. Yeah, that's a great point.
I think another big mistake that I made with online coaching was guaranteeing a response time within 24 hours. That was a big mistake. And the interesting thing about these mistakes is all the intent was good. I wanted to let them know that I was there for them, that they could always reach out to me, that I would be there to respond. One of the major issues with guaranteeing a 24-hour response time is they don't have the opportunity to learn for themselves. So if someone emails me and they're like, oh, I'm super nervous, I'm going out to eat, I'm worried that like I'm going to ruin all my progress, and I reply immediately being like, you're going to be fine, it's okay, don't worry about it. They don't have time to go through it themselves and process the emotion without me being there. And what I realized is once I changed my response time to 48, 72 hours plus, they would email me. They'd be like, I'm super nervous, I'm worried, I think I'm going to ruin all my progress. Then they actually go out to the dinner and I don't reply. Then they email me the next day and say, hey, disregard my last email, I'm totally fine.
Okay.
It was an overreaction. And when I started getting those emails, I realized I was taking away their opportunity to learn, and I was sort of providing a cushion that would hurt them long term, because then they would depend on that cushion. Mm-hmm. And if the cushion wasn't there, then they would freak out. By not giving them that cushion, they went into it, they faced their fear, and then the next day they could be more logical about what actually happened.
And this is what happens when you're a parent. This exact same thing. You want to jump in and save your kid from anything, right? Yep. You want to save and help and whatever, and learning when to jump in and when to stay back. And invariably, they learn more when you can be as hands-off, you know, as a parent as you can, and help guide them or whatever. But it's the same thing. I totally get it.
Makes total sense.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, this has been a pleasure.
This has been more than a pleasure.
Can you tell people where they can find you on Instagram or your own podcast or anywhere on social media?
You can find me really almost everywhere right now. And everything is Susan Niebergall Fitness. And so it's N-I-E-B-E-R. N-I-E. Yeah, the I before the E. And Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I have a podcast called The Strong and Lean at Any Age Podcast, and YouTube are my primary places.
I love it. Yeah. Thank you. This was great.
This was amazing.
I love you. I'll talk to you soon.
Love you.
That wraps it up for this episode of the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed it, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes if you haven't done that already, because they've been helping a lot. The podcast has been growing, and I'm very appreciative for every single one of you who are listening. And that is all I'm going to say, because otherwise I'll keep rambling. Have a wonderful day.